watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, 88.1, Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP, Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP, Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The oppression of women, patriarchy, is the granddaddy of all forms of repressive social hierarchies, the most ancient slavery practiced by the human race. It has been justified as, quote, natural or, quote, divinely ordained. But the culture of the Haudenosaunee in central New York provided an example of the falsity of that view and fueled the women's rights movement in America. This week, we'll look at some histories of women's struggle in America, even as the forces of patriarchal theocracy are on the march today. We begin with Professor John Marciano's discussion of Howard Zinn's history on feminist struggles in the U.S.
Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race.
Our focus tonight is the intimately oppressed, or as the English feminist Juliette Mitchell called it, the longest revolution. Women have essentially been invisible in U.S. history, not just in U.S. history, of course, but that's what we're going to be focusing on, even though my comments will draw from other areas. This has been justified by the argument that biology is destiny. And if you recall our previous discussions on American Indians and Africans and African Americans, just women connected to biology as destiny, just as oppressed racial minorities have been tied to biology and nature. That is, where physical characteristics are used to deny historical power relations created and sustained by men of power, not nature. Oppression, Zinn is arguing very clearly, the oppression has nothing to do with nature. It has to do with society. It has to do with culture. Women have been kept in their place by ideological means, such as the Bible, the religious messages in the Bible and the Christian and other traditions, through tradition in this country, but also through sexual abuse and violence. Because I will argue that behind the velvet glove of ideas lies the iron fist of violence. And I would make the same argument in terms of the racist oppression in the United States toward indigenous peoples and African Americans. And that the violence and oppression visited upon women crosses all class, cultural, and ethnic boundaries. It's transhistorical, and it has been deeply, deeply rooted in the entire history of this country. At the same time, as you see from Zinn's discussion, women have resisted their oppression despite facing special disabilities and living right underneath the eyes and with those who have often been their oppressors. This resistance became formally organized in the mid-19th century with the rise of the women's suffrage movement, and we'll get to that. Thomas Jefferson's phrase in the Declaration of Independence that, quote, all men are created equal, meant just that. Women had no formal political power at that time, and in the terms of the federal level, women had no formal political power until they gained, after a long struggle, the right to vote in 1920. The women had the right to vote in certain states prior to that time. This suffrage was gained over decades of agitation and organization and never given as a gift by male authorities. Recall the quote I shared with you from Frederick Douglass about change and struggle, that those in power never accede to change without a struggle, and his quote applies very, very well to the feminist movement and the struggle by women generally to gain equality in the United States. An early feminist challenge to gender inequality, Zinn discusses this, came from Mary Wollstonecraft in England, the mother of Mary Shelley, who was the author who was to write Frankenstein. Wollstonecraft's brilliant critique of male supremacy is found in her major work, A Vindication of the Rights of Women, which was published in 1792. She opposed the state of ignorance and servility to which women were condemned by social custom and training. She argued, and I quote, "Women are told from their infancy and taught by the example of their mothers that a little knowledge of human weakness, just termed cunning, softness of temper, outward appearance, and a scrupulous attention to a puerile kind of propriety will obtain for them the protection of man." She said that my objection extends to the entire purport of those books on women which tend to degrade one half of the human species and render women pleasing at the expense of every solid virtue. She harshly criticized the influential male philosophers and writers of her time who asserted that female education ought to be directed to one point, to render them pleasing. And I quote again from Wollstonecraft, "I lament that women are systematically degraded by receiving the trivial attentions which men think it manly to pay to their sex when in fact they are insultingly supporting their own superiority." Zinn and others have argued that we must try to understand the gender power relations discussed by Wollstonecraft, both historically and theoretically. For example, the contemporary feminist poet and writer Adrienne Rich argues that since all human life on the planet is born of woman, most of us first know love and disappointment, power and tenderness in the person of a woman. We carry that imprint of this experience for life. She argues that there is much to suggest that males have been haunted by the force of this idea of dependence on a woman for life itself. Women have provided continuity and stability, but also the rejections and refusals of our early lives. And it is with a woman's hands, eyes, body, voice, that we associate our primal sensations, our earliest social experience. Two fundamental ideas come down to us in the United States and other societies as well, especially in the Christian West, that have been influenced by the Bible and that have profoundly shaped our conceptions of gender in Western history. On one hand, females are impure and corrupt, and on the other hand, they are beneficent, sacred, pure, asexual, and nourishing. A number of feminists have argued that maternity and sexuality have been channeled to serve these bipolar, conflicting views and for male interests, and that behavior by women that threatens this foundation and patriarchal institutions is considered deviant or criminal. Mothers bear in the Christian West the weight of Eve's transgression, eating from the forbidden tree of knowledge. We're all familiar with that story. But the social theorist and refugee from German fascism, Erich Fromm, wrote some years ago that Eve's act of rebellion was the first step toward human liberation and freedom in history. Most of us, all of us, especially in the U.S., in one way or another, were taught or learned, however, that she was the first offender, the polluted one, who disobeyed God and therefore disobeyed men. Religion, therefore, has been very, very critical in justifying women's oppression, as with American Indians and with slaves. And the Bible offers ample support for misogyny, the hatred of women. Josephine Henry, a leading 19th century suffragist, castigated the churches for their consistently sexist attitude over the century. She stated, "Has the church ever issued an edict that women must have equal rights with men before the canon or civil law? No institution in modern civilization is so tyrannical and so unjust to women as is the Christian church. It demands everything from her and gives nothing in return. The history of the church does not contain a single suggestion for the equality of women. Through tyranny and falsehood alone is Christianity able to hold women in subjection. Or as perhaps the greatest 19th century agnostic orator in the United States, Colonel Robert Ingersoll, stated, as long as women regard the Bible as the charter of their rights, they will be the slave of man. When Elizabeth Cady Stanton, in the middle of the 19th century, asserted about religion, remains with us. Quote, the Bible and the church have been the greatest stumbling blocks to women's emancipation. The Bible was used to support women's oppression, and Christian men used it to keep women silent, submissive, and uneducated for centuries. Challenges to this worldview have come from those who opposed such oppression. And of course it has been opposed, especially since the rise of the suffragist movement in the middle of the 19th century in the United States. These women in turn, and their few male allies, were vilified for raising such objections and opposed by every leading religious and political institution in the society. The inferior status of women is built upon a biblical misogyny in which the ideal is the submissive woman. The Bible, leading theologians, and over the centuries the Roman Catholic Church shaped the dominant patriarchal thinking. Quote, wives, submit yourselves to your husband as unto the Lord. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their husbands in everything. It's from Ephesians. Quote, the head of every man is Christ, and the head of every woman is man. Corinthians. St. Thomas Aquinas, woman is defective and misbegotten. And last but not least, the virulently anti-Semitic Martin Luther, quote, God created Adam Lord of all living creatures, but Eve spoiled it all. If a woman grows weary and dies from childbearing, it matters not. In the Middle Ages, untold thousands and thousands of women were condemned as witches by the church during the Inquisition and burned at the stake, drawing from the line in Exodus, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. These victims were often women who were midwives and healers who challenged the power and authority of men and the church. When the Grimke sisters, who were both abolitionists and feminists, spoke at anti-slavery conventions in the 1830s, they broke a public and religious convention in the United States that forbade women to appear on public platforms. A pastoral letter from the Congregational Church, they were Southerners, by the way, they were from South Carolina as well. A pastoral letter from the Congregational Church was issued against them. Quote, when a woman assumes the place and tone of a man as a public reformer, she yields the power which God has given her for her protection, and her character becomes unnatural. But this did not stop Sarah Grimke, who stated, quote, that all history attests that man has subjected women to his will, used her as a means to promote his selfish gratification, to minister to his sensual pleasures, to be instrumental in promoting his comfort, but never has he desired to elevate her to that rank she was created to fill. Women, instead of being elevated by her union with man, generally loses her individuality, her independent character and moral being. She becomes absorbed into him and henceforth is looked at and acts through the medium of her husband. As with racism and slavery, therefore, and other forms of oppression that we see and deal with all the time today, religious ideas have been used to keep an oppressive system in place as a way of blocking the oppressed group from challenging and changing it. Recalling Frederick Douglass's quote on agitation and change, without resistance from women, without a suffrage movement, without a feminist movement, we would still be following the Congregational Church's view in this country. Zinn spends a little time talking about another period in the 19th century, that is the rise of industrial capitalism, especially in the northeastern United States, which brought with it the rise of what historians called the cult of true womanhood or femininity. This was popularized through the new ladies' magazines and romance novels, though it was profoundly class and racial based. It was aimed at white women who are more privileged and who were seen as the inhabitants of a sphere totally severed and separate from the realm of productive work. As the factory system emerges, the home becomes known as the haven in the heartless world. Of course, this sphere and this ideology does not apply to black women, free or slaves, or poor immigrants. Men would go into the world while their women would make a lovely place in the home. The cleavage between the home and work, therefore, that was brought on by industrial capitalism in a very powerful way enhanced the notion of female inferiority more than ever as women became synonymous with mother and housewife. The Haven in the Heartless World thesis revealed a hard world as industrial capitalism unfolded in the nation, with the home seen at least for the more affluent classes as a utopian and protected environment. The cult of true womanhood was an attempt to influence women to accept their separate but supposedly equal role in society. But of course, we don't have to read Zinn to know that it was never equal, as women could not vote, could not own property, could not obtain similar pay to men, and were excluded from the professions of law and medicine and from colleges and the ministry. As historian Angela Davis points out, the cult of true womanhood in the 19th century did not extend to slaves, who were inherently vulnerable to all forms of sexual coercion. The special abuse of women facilitated the ruthless exploitation of their labor. The ideology of femininity for white middle-class women did not apply to black women, who were certainly not too feminine to work in coal mines, iron foundries, as lumberjacks, ditch diggers, or railroad workers, as many of the southern railroads were built using female slave labor. Despite the middle-class image of the Haven, however, from the earliest settled life until the rise of factories as the center of production, the home, certainly in colonial and then U.S. of A., was not a refuge, was not a place for leisure and retreat from the cruelty of the outside world. And that doesn't just apply to the United States, of course. It has always been a part of the world, a center of work, a subsistence unit. This changed, however, in very profound ways with the rise of industrial capitalism that brought crucial changes in Western assumptions about the home, about work, about women, and about women's relationship to productivity. As increasingly only men would be seen as doing productive and paid work outside the home, even though increasingly and slowly women also did paid and productive work outside the home. The harsh reality faced by the wives of working-class men, for example, contradicted the ideal of the home as a protected place apart from the brutal conditions of the workplace. For example, in the 19th and early 20th century, poor women had many children with several miscarriages, most of them with no prenatal care and inadequate diet. Their anxiety and physical depletion from childbearing and rearing was legion, and many took drugs to bring on abortions against their principles and their husbands' opposition. Zinn also discusses the great event in terms of this issue that shaped the 19th century, perhaps in the history of the United States, the most important political meeting in this country. That is the Women's Rights Convention in July 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York, 40 or 50 miles from where I used to live. I've been at the Women's Hall of Fame, I've been at Elizabeth Cady Stanton's house in Seneca Falls, and in nearby Auburn, New York, is the home of Harriet Tubman. That meeting was organized by Stanton and by Lucretia Mott. 1848, revolutions in Europe, a year of incredible change throughout Europe, the same year that Marx and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto. 300 people attended that convention in Seneca Falls, but James Mott, Lucretia's husband, had to chair it since no woman dared chair such a meeting at that time. Mott and Stanton deliberately used the Declaration of Independence as a guide to forge the Declaration of Sentiments that emerged from that historic meeting. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman." 11 resolutions on women's issues were passed unanimously at that meeting, but the 12th, which was about granting women the right to vote, passed only by a narrow margin after the great African-American abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who was the only black person in attendance, defended it from the floor. In an editorial in his paper, The North Star, in Rochester, New York, shortly after the meeting, Douglass supported the women's struggle for the vote. And I quote, "We are free to say that in regard to political rights, we hold women to be justly entitled to all that we claim for man. All political rights which are expedient for man to exercise are equally so for women. All that distinguishes man as an intelligent and accountable being is equally true of woman. Our doctrine is that right is of no sex." That reality, however, has not been the reality that has dominated the society, as the writer Kate Millett argued about 30 years ago in her very powerful book, Sexual Politics, when she asserted at that time, and I would argue that it continues, that this society is and has been essentially and fundamentally patriarchal because men control the economy, the state and its agents, and the military, and have a monopoly on sexual violence. Patriarchy penetrates class divisions and different societies. It cuts through all of those. Men establish their power and maintain control in all societies, and all social groups within this are therefore sexist in the sense that their fundamental organization at every level is predicated on the domination of one sex by the other. While ideology or ideas from the Bible and other sources have been absolutely critical in reproducing power relationships, the power relationships of patriarchy, ultimately, these ideas reflect actual physical power. And behind the ideas has been, since the beginning of the colonial period, it didn't start, of course, with the United States, but this is the one we have to understand, that the level of violence against females has been staggering and remains staggering to this day, especially when we realize that most attacks on women are not reported. A couple of years ago, for an op-ed piece, I did some research, and I recall it was a long article in the LA Times. There's absolute voluminous literature on this. But there was an article in the LA Times citing some data from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, which estimated at that time, this was 2001, that 4.9 million women in the United States were raped and physically assaulted by intimate partners. 4.9 million, and that is an undercount. This was for the year 2001, just in that year. This is a far greater figure than the FBI stats. And that, I did a little calculation, that was roughly 94,000 per week in the United States. And then I calculated it roughly with the population of Los Angeles County, which that brought it down to 2,600 assaults per week. And then in Santa Monica, it's a little less than 1% of the population of the county, that's roughly 26 a week. If this level of assault, I want to make an argument that we discussed when I quoted from David Stannard's work on the American Holocaust, if this level of assault and violence was carried out on any other socially identified group in this society, for example, blacks, Jews, priests, corporate CEOs, members of Congress, there would be an outrage and action that would be staggering. But it has not been forthcoming in this society because, as David Stannard argued with American Indians, we rank the victims of violence, and women as a group are not worthy victims, despite all of the individual stories that we hear and that clearly we identify with. And I've not been able to find out in looking at FBI reports and other data to what extent the percentage of mere assaults, what percentage of those are reported. Katha Pollitt, writer for the Nation magazine, suggests that responses to such violence in this society often include routine expressions of shock and focus on the behavior of the victim. However, she believes that we must stop thinking of male violence as some kind of freak of nature, like a tornado, that actually it's quite common and ordinary. It's as American as apple pie, and it has been deeply rooted in the soil of this society since the beginning. And I would suggest, that drawing off of Zinn, Pollitt, and others, that this outrage, this being the physical expression of the deep-seated misogyny that is in every single institution in this society, that this outrage will not end until, one, there's an awareness of the root causes of patriarchy and terror. Where does this come from? How did it develop? And then, two, with that analysis, agitation and organization to end both. Because as we've seen with regard to every other issue we've discussed, and our knowledge of American history is and the history of other societies is certainly ample enough to know that nothing worthwhile ever changes without a struggle and without those in power being confronted, whether they be slave owners or patriarchal masters.
John Marciano, Professor Emeritus of SUNY Cortland, from his public discussion group in Los Angeles on Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. Thanks to Richard Ingram and the LA Sound Posse for that recording. See lasoundposse.org. Next, we're pleased to bring you the second part of a collaborative educational series about the Onondaga Nation and their historic land claim in central New York. This week, Visionary Women, the Haudenosaunee and the U.S. Women's Rights Movement. Professor Linda Olcott of Syracuse University is the moderator and introduces the speakers.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome you to our event tonight, Visionary Women, the Haudenosaunee and the U.S. Women's Rights Movement. I'm the Director of Women's Studies at SU. We have a wonderful program tonight with Jeannie Shenandoah and Sally Roche Wagner that is fitting for Women's History Month, as well as this series. Before introducing our speakers, let me say a word about the series. This is the largest collaboration I've been involved in almost 20 years in Syracuse. It includes faculty from both Syracuse University and Environmental Sciences and Forestry School, as well as community groups. The Nation has really brought us together in an unprecedented way. The purpose of the series is to provide information for the whole community about the Onondaga land rights claim, which affects all of us, and also to make a space for public discussion about it. We will have events focused on the specifics of the land claim, but the claim also must be understood in its historical, political, and cultural context. I want to just say one word about why the Women's Studies program wanted to support this whole series. There's a common idea that the movement for women's equality began among Europeans and then has spread elsewhere. That idea is historically inaccurate, and it also has some unfortunate ramifications for how we think about who we have to learn from, who are the teachers and who are the learners among us. So we in the Women's Studies program want to help correct the story of women's history. Let me just say also that between now and the next event in our series, which is advertised in your program, there's another event that this audience will be interested in, and that is Wilma Mankiller is coming to speak at Syracuse University on Tuesday, March 28th at 7 o'clock in Hendricks Chapel. Wilma Mankiller is, she served for 2 years as the first female elected deputy chief and for 10 years as the first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. Her newest book, just recently out, is called Every Day is a Good Day, and she's one of a handful of Native American recipients of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So please mark that on your calendar, Tuesday, March 28th at 7 p.m. at Hendricks Chapel. Okay, let me introduce our speakers now. We will have time for questions and discussion after the presentation. Our two speakers are Jeannie Shenandoah and Sally Roche Wagner. Jeannie Shenandoah is a member of the Eel Clan from the Onondaga Nation. She's been a traditional home birth midwife and herbalist for 23 years. She is a mother and a grandmother, and she works at the Onondaga Nation Communications Office. And she describes herself as involved with spiritual and political activities of her people and following the traditional ways. She has spent most of her life being involved with people, helping people obtain knowledge to maintain who they are. She serves on the Haudenosaunee Environmental Task Force and is former vice president of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Foundation. Sally Roche Wagner was one of the first women to receive a doctorate for work in women's studies in the United States from the University of California, Santa Cruz in 1978. She is also a founder of one of the country's first women's studies programs at California State University in Sacramento. She was a women's studies professor for 34 years and now is the executive director of the Gage Foundation in Fayetteville, New York, and she really is the nation's foremost authority on Matilda Jocelyn Gage. So please join me in welcoming our speakers tonight, Jeannie Shenandoah and Sally Roche Wagner.
Sally Roche Wagner.
First, I'd like to thank the people that have done so much work to make this event possible, this long discussion that will go on for a year, and to also tell you how honored I feel to be part of it. Tonight, I'll begin with a little bit about what it was for women in the 19th century, non-Native women, and then Jeannie and I will continue the conversation. If you were Lucretia Mott in 1848, you came from Philadelphia and came to the Seneca Nation and spent a good bit of time there, watching as the nation was deciding if it would continue in its traditional governmental and spiritual ways or if it would adopt a system similar to the United States. You were a Quaker, a member of Philadelphia Friends Meeting. And the energy that you brought from that experience of watching women taking part as full equal partners in the decision and also planning the spiritual ceremony that went on at the time she was there. You came to a meeting with an old friend that you'd known or met 8 years before, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and together you planned what was the first Women's Rights Convention, as far as we know, in the United States. If you were Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you had an uncle who spoke the Oneida language fluently. Your cousin, Garrett Smith, the son of Peter Smith, the Oneida speaker, was always welcoming a number of people to his home in Peterboro, including fugitive slaves, Native people, and, as Elizabeth Cady Stanton's husband, Henry, said, radical reformers of every ilk. You would see Oneida women there, or you would see Onondaga women, if you were Elizabeth Cady Stanton, living in Seneca Falls in 1848, at the home of your nearest neighbor, who Orrin Tyler had been had run a trading post at the Onondaga Nation and spoke Onondaga fluently. And whenever the newspapers reported, his Onondaga relatives came to visit, they stayed with him. Or you might have seen Seneca women selling their baskets on the streets of Seneca Falls, as they always did. If you were Matilda Jocelyn Gage, you might leave your home at 210 East Genesee and travel to the Onondaga Nation for ceremony. You knew a number of the people at Onondaga by name. Some of them came to visit you in your home. And Matilda Jocelyn Gage was, in 1878... the editor of a women's rights paper here in Syracuse at a time when the state of New York was considering a bill that would force citizenship on Indian men, on the Haudenosaunee. The chiefs met in council at the nation and decided that they would not accept citizenship, that they were citizens of their own nations, and Matilda Jocelyn Gage wrote an editorial in support of their decision in her women's rights paper. And she said, isn't it the height of hypocrisy that the government, which is denying citizenship to its women citizens who are demanding it, is attempting to force citizenship on Indian men, the better to steal their lands? Justice to the Indians requires living up to the treaties that have been made with them, and to force citizenship on them would be equivalent to forcing it on Canadians or Mexicans, because the members of the Six Nations of the Haudenosaunee are equally sovereign nations with Canada and Mexico. Now, the question, the story for me was, how did this connection be made? You know, how was this connection made? How did Native and non-Native women know each other? What did non-Native women see when they saw Haudenosaunee women? And first, I want to just very quickly go over with you to remind you of what it was for non-Native women, citizens of the United States in the state of New York, in, say, 1848. First of all, you wore a dress. You wore a long skirt, and underneath you corseted. And you corseted to a tiny waist, and you, as a result, couldn't take a deep breath. You suffered a number of physical complaints, and women died in childbirth as a result of the corseting that forced their vital organs downward and made childbirth a very dangerous procedure. You also, in addition to your dress, which was both symbolic and also it kept you literally in your place, the law and the church made sure that you knew what your place was. Common law was based on canon law, and under canon law, essentially the two shall become one and the one is the man, and that was the basis of common law in terms of women. So that when Blackstone's Code was adopted after the Revolutionary War in this country, it meant that women once married were dead in the law, was the phrase. It wasn't that they had no rights, they simply ceased to exist legally. The two became one, and the one was the man. That meant that you had no rights to your children, and the extreme examples were things like a husband in this area who knew he was dying, and Matilda Jocelyn Gage wrote this story, wanted someone else to take care of this child once it was born, and so he willed this child away from the mother. He died, the mother gave birth to the child, and the child was taken away from her. She had absolutely no legal right to the child. He appointed someone else as guardian, and the law, of course, recognized that. Husbands had the legal and the spiritual, not just right, but responsibility to chastise their wives, to make sure that their wives were obedient. If, as the Bible literally understood, says that the husband stands in relation to the wife as the wife stands, or has the husband, the wife stands in relation to the husband as the husband stands in relation to Christ. So the husband is the Lord and Master, And from Genesis to St. Paul, the theme recurs that she is to be subservient to him and she is to be obedient to him. In the 19th century, when you married, the wife did say that she would obey the husband. That was part of the marriage ceremony. So the responsibility of the husband was to ensure that his wife would make it to heaven. And if, in fact, she died in disobedience to him, she would not go to heaven. And so he had the obligation, if you will, to ensure her spiritual survival. And that meant making sure that she never was in a state of disobedience to him. And so husbands could beat their wives. And a Supreme Court in one of the southern states in the 1870s heard a case where a woman had been severely beaten by her husband. But the Supreme Court said that he had not broken a law, because unless permanent injury was inflicted, he was certainly within his rights as a husband. And for the court to intervene in this case would be to upset, they said, the domestic tranquility of the home. You had no right to your property. You had no right to your wages. Whatever you brought into the marriage became the property of your husband's to do with as he would. And there were, well, I won't go into the examples of it. You probably are all aware of them. Elizabeth Cady Stanton put it this way, that even if a woman is an heiress and an incredibly wealthy property owner, she, once she marries, becomes penniless and homeless. And this, in fact, she had seen these cases when her father was an attorney and she was a small child, and she would hide out in his office and listen to the women crying when they left his office, and he could do nothing about it because the law allowed the husband to have all of his wife's property and wages, everything she had. So the condition of women in the 19th century was, of course, one of being political slaves as well. Women had no say in government in any of its levels. They could not testify in court. They could not sue or be sued. They could not vote. So the condition of women being virtually, once married, non-existent, was held to be both God's divine plan and biologically an imperative, that this is just simply how women are. They are helpless, they are dependent, they cannot survive on their own, and so the creation of male and female in their biological essence dictates that the husband must be the responsible person, and she must be the submissive person. So how do you break through this? You've got church, you've got state, you've got social order, all science as it emerges, all saying the same thing and saying that if a woman is dissatisfied with this position and wants to do something about it, she is unnatural biologically, she is blasphemous religiously, she is a heretic, and she's not going to be a good wife and mother. Now, what happened when these women living under these conditions saw Haudenosaunee women? What did they see?
Well, it depends. I guess you have to think about how these women came into our communities.
Jeannie Shenandoah.
And what they say. So a large number of these women that were involved in organizing for women's rights around the Seneca Falls time were the majority of them were the wives of missionaries who had moved into our communities. So they didn't just observe from the outside. They were living inside of our community, so they saw how things were working there. First of all, I should tell you that our people are matrilineal. We have we're born into clan families. The Onondaga Nation here has 9 clan families, and all of the children are born into the mother's clan, regardless of who the father is. You follow the clan family of your mother. So probably these women came into the communities and were astounded to see that women had equal rights. And I shouldn't say just women. I should say everybody, all the people Nobody was ever treated like they were more than another person. Everybody was on equal responsibility, an equal level. Everybody had opportunity to voice their opinions and take part in any kind of gatherings where people needed to make decisions or to speak. First of all, I should tell you that the clan families that we have are very large extended families. And and each clan has this woman who usually, but not always, is one of the oldest women in this family. And she's somebody that's been chosen by the people to represent them, to look out for a person that is looked at for the way that she's led her life and been responsible and respectful and considerate to all the people, a person who has shown good human traits. So this woman is chosen, and she helps to make a decision in talking along with the people in her clan to choose who are person will be that most of you know of as the chief, or the you think of him as like the head of our family, where actually who he is he's the spokesperson and also the person that watches out for all the people that belong to this clan, this large extended family. He and this woman work together and make sure, watch out for everybody's well-being, all the people, men, women, and children, and they make sure that our ceremonies are done properly and at the right time. They must be a very good spiritual person because they have the responsibility of making sure that our ceremonies are done properly and that all of our people learn the proper procedures and the ways to conduct their ceremonies when the proper time is. So it's a pretty big job that takes all of one's personal life to take this position. And they're normally not, like I said, set aside as someone different than the rest of the people. So these two people would be the spokespeople for the whole family. The whole family, the whole clan would gather and discuss issues. And so those women probably came and saw this, where everybody had an equal voice and everybody had a right to everything. And since we are matrilineal people, the women had the right to I guess you would want to think about it as owning property. Although most of our property is held in common. For instance, here at Onondaga Nation, nearby here, the whole of our property is held in common by the whole community. You might take a portion of it where your home is and say, this is my yard or this is my garden, but you actually can't go out and sell it out to real estate or something because it belongs to all of us. It belongs to us communally. That's probably another thing those women saw, and they probably also saw the issues along food, where our people have always been agricultural type people. We are not nomadic. We've stayed in our Aboriginal territories in villages for a pretty long length of time and had some really extensive gardens and fruit orchards. And so they probably saw this. The women had a lot to do with the food, but I don't think it was basically women. Sometimes I think people are looking to look for the word of the women have the power or something, but it's not like that at all. It's more equality. People share it together. It's not a proper human balance if somebody would have the power over someone else. We're all equally human people, and we all share responsibilities of living together in a community. I think that's what those women also saw, which was a lot of change for them, and also the fact that the children follow the clan family for their identification, as opposed to the women not having any right to their own natural-born children being given away from them. And those are probably some of the things that they've seen that help them to to strive for this equality for themselves.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking about the clothing, too, that right here at Syracuse University up in Special Collections, there's a dress from 1848 from the Oneida community, the Utopian community, and the history of women's rights usually talks about the first reform costume being the bloomer costume. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Cady Stanton wore it. Her cousin Elizabeth Smith Miller, Gerrit Smith's daughter, was the first, the history books say. But this was 3 years before Elizabeth Smith Miller wore the trousers and the short skirt. And it's not trousers. It's leggings. And they're leggings that connect by buttons to the overdress, you know. It's sort of, whoa, I wonder where white women got the idea of leggings. Julie, our friend Julie Unicone, was doing research when we first did the Sisters in Spirit exhibit in Seneca Falls for the 150th anniversary, and she found the actual account of the making of that first dress, and they described it in an Indian cabin. We worked until late at night making this dress, and it actually was a cabin that had been Oneida before the Oneida community.
Yeah, I think there were probably surprises on both sides also for our women to be living in these communities with a sense of equality and humanness, where everybody was the same and everybody had equal rights or equal voice to meet these women who came along who were so severely oppressed. Mm-hmm. That I'm sure it made a lot of impression on, mm-hmm. on our women and developed a lot of friendships. Actually, although things have changed over time, like everything evolves, we still to this day have are still matrilineal people, and our children are born to us and follow our clans. We have our ceremonies. We have our women and our men who have been chosen to be the spokespeople for our clan families. We have to work very hard to maintain this because the influence of the world around us is very, very strong, and it would lead many people away. So those of us that follow these ways have to constantly be aware of what's around us and what's threatening our existence all the time. So these things are still going on, and I forgot what I was going to say. I went blank. I just kind of wanted to mention that, you know, living our life, I guess, myself, for a good portion of my life, having been able to live, to follow these ways, probably, I guess I didn't realize how bad things had been for these women when the invasion happened and they came along to live with us. So as we all know, that they don't tell the truth in school. They don't tell the truth in history. There are so many things that we don't need to know, even about ourselves or each other. Mm-hmm. So it's been a real awakening for me to be learning all these things from Sally here, and then probably helped me to realize how precious some of our community ways are that we maybe take, not absolutely take for granted, but that we feel comfortable in, that we haven't had to go through such a long, great fight from the oppression of the dominance.
You know, I was thinking about that time when your mom and you and I spoke in Seneca Falls. It was one of the Elizabeth Cady Stanton birthday luncheons, and I was really going to town with quoting Elizabeth Cady Stanton and how impressed she was, you know, about the power of these Iroquois women and how the Klan mothers had cut off the horns of the chiefs, and talking about rights, And when your mom started talking about the responsibilities, it was, you know, one of those moments of, culture reflection. The difference between rights and responsibilities, you know, rights are what you talk about when you're wanting them.
Mm-hmm.
Responsibilities are what you talk about once you've achieved a gender balance and you need to maintain the harmony, I think.
Yeah.
Was your mom's insight?
Yeah, I think so. I think we need to set that straight, that so many people everywhere are always approaching us, women, because they said they're looking for the power. The women have the power. There is no power if there's dominance. We have to all be equal together. And so many times women have come, and I'm asking about the responsibilities of the clan mothers and the faith keepers. They look to them as leaders of our people. You could say that they're leaders, but they're very good leaders because they lead us by the heart. Our spirit comes first. They're spiritual teachers. And then other things that people have heard about, like Sally had referred to take the power away from a man, you know, to take the horns off him, to take his power away from him and do away with him, which from my perspective isn't a time where I would look at doing anything to somebody like that as power. I look at a time like that, if such a horrible time came in somebody's life, that would mean that a time came in somebody's life that was so sad and so just couldn't even turn it around or to do anything to it because a horrible, some kind of mistake or something happened. And then if this man had been in a position where he had been chosen to be one of the spokespeople for his clan family, then he must have been a very good person, and something happened along the way. So I look at that time as a very sad time. It would make me really, really sad in my heart and feel bad for these people who had to take part in it. So that's another thing that needs to be straightened up when people look at the power of ripping the horns off of somebody's head. It would be so sad. It would be like almost like ending somebody's life because this person would be banished from us because whatever happened was so bad it couldn't be turned around. And you should know that before that time came, there was probably extensive time spent talking and trying to reconcile this situation and repair it. And probably a lot of people were affected. So we need to think about that. It's not a time of power. It's a time of great sadness, I would say.
Mm-hmm. You know, that knowing you, the constant mirroring of the reflection of who I am in the society, the government, the world in which I live, mirrored from the reflection of yours is always just an amazement. You know, I was thinking about the when you were talking about history, we haven't always learned the truth or
true.
The understanding.
They don't tell
it.
Us the truth in school. We all know that.
And you know and beyond that, it's, you know, it's the illusion that we know, and the higher our degree, the bigger the illusion of knowing. And you know, and I think about when I never set out to find this connection. It, you know, it carried me kicking and screaming and resisting all the way. And that's really been a reflection to think about why. Why didn't I see this? First chapter of Matilda Jocelyn Gage's Woman, Church, and State, her major book, she talks about never was justice more perfect, never was civilization higher. And she's talking about the Haudenosaunee. Well, I was trying to figure out how, especially Gage and Stanton, the two most radical, I think, in the true sense of that term, historically, that the radical reformers in this area talked about the deadly tree of oppression, and you cut it off at the roots. You can't just cut off the limbs, it grows stronger. You can't make minor liberal reforms. You have to dig it out at the roots, hence radical.